That's Segundo here. It would be very difficult to explain how the Speed Racer cartoon led me astray in my youth. For a very long time, I figured that if I found a way to drive a fast car, I'd be living a life full of adventure, with Trixie in her helicopter above me, or someone named Trixie, or perhaps someone I could call Trixie. Maybe I'd even find my long-lost older brother. None of this, however, happened, and I am here introducing a lame podcast. And it may just be one of the reasons my voice has gone all funny.
Okay, so I am here with Peter Fernandez and Corrine Orr, who are voiceover artists who are known for Speed Racer, Marine Boy, and Star Blazers, and a number of other things. Peter and Corrine, how are you doing?
Oh, we're just great.
Fine. Can I just correct one thing? Voiceover artists?
Yeah, we don't like that term.
Oh, okay. Well, what would be the proper term then?
Well, just actors.
Actors.
Actors, okay.
Because we do every kind of media going, and we start off as actors.
Yeah, I think this is a San Francisco term I sort of took with me to New York. Or
it's an everybody term.
What's the specific problem with voiceover artists?
Because my point is, I really only started making this point about a year ago, is that an actor is an actor, and he can come up with loads of voices that he's probably never used. Maybe when a kid and hoping to be an actor, he practiced things in front of the mirror. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if he's a good actor, he can come up with a voice for whatever character he's portraying.
Gotcha. Well, I first off want to ask, and it's a very obvious question, but I don't know the answer. So how did you two hook up? I mean, surely it wasn't just with Speed Racer.
No, I met Corrine at a company called Titra, where we dubbed a lot of foreign films into English, feature films, wonderful films. And that's where I met Corrine. She started doing little boy voices in them. Mm-hmm. And slating.
Well, I came from Canada, and someone had given me the address of Titra, and I had had a daily show in Montreal. And I came here, and I knew no one. And because I could do little kids and the others couldn't, I started working. Mm-hmm. So I got, that was fun, but I was thrilled to do anything, you know.
Well, I'm curious, when you, did you work together initially, or did you actually go in through a number of various actors, and Corrine fit the bill for Speed Racer?
No. I was familiar with her work,
okay,
because I was a writer-director at Titra.
That's right.
So I was familiar with what she could do, perhaps a little more familiar than some of the other directors, because there was a man named Fred Ladd who did Astro Boy and Gigantor, and he never called Corrine at that time.
He did later, though.
Later, but,
I did lots.
He didn't call Corrine, and then suddenly there she is doing Speed Racer and Marine Boy. And I think Fred became aware because he was sort of using just the same three actors in everything he did.
Yeah. Did he offer any reason why he didn't use the lovely Corrine's talents here? Or?
Well, he already had somebody doing boys.
She was good, Billy Lou White. She was real good.
Was there a stigma in terms of female actors doing boys at the time?
No, everybody did it. Not everybody, but it was common because they were coming out of the radio era, and people had doubled and tripled in shows. So,
On radio, though, and I grew up partly doing the radio shows from the East Coast, which is where most of the dramatic shows came from, and they used real kids.
Yeah.
There was one boy named Ronald Hiss who started doing radio when he was a year and a half. He could read.
Really?
And he was quite a bit. I mean, he went to the same school I did, and they skipped him three grades.
I knew him. I loved him.
I've listened to a lot of old-time radio, and I have actually heard children on this, so that's definitely true. Actually, this brings up a question I wanted to ask both of you in terms of animation and anime sort of reflecting this old-time radio feel, or rather, there's a whole generation who grew up who didn't listen to old-time radio. I only discovered it just by complete curiosity. And I'm wondering if you feel, both as actors, that there has been something lost in the last 40 years.
I'd like to address that. My favorite medium of all time is radio, and it always will be. You know, you've heard the cliche, theater of the mind.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely true. Every listener had a different picture of what he was listening to in his head. And it was a marvelous medium, and great for actors. It was live.
We do a convention each year called Friends of Old Time Radio in New Jersey, and it's glorious. They recreate all the old shows with some of the original actors who are still alive, and they use other people to do the shows, and it's great fun. We do it each year, and I just won an award last year.
Oh, really? Congratulations.
Fun. Thank you.
Well, I mean, it's we're talking about radio as it was a fabulous medium. Do you think that there's absolutely no hope, particularly in this podcasting era? I mean, here we are talking on a podcast of old-time radio returning? Or?
I don't think it can ever return, because now it's a commercial every 3 minutes on whatever you're watching or listening to, 3 or 4 minutes. However, I was thinking of maybe devising 3-minute segments of soap operas, of, you know, original ones, not going back to the old ones, and having a little brief drama or comedy, whatever, lasting only for the 3 minutes. What stations would run it, I don't know, because, you know, you need X amount of stations to pay for it.
But what I'm suggesting is that here we have this podcasting medium in which this isn't a factor, in which you can have perhaps a sponsor an entire podcast. So I'm wondering if there's any hope of old-time radio, this lengthy 30-minute drama, actually.
I don't think there's an audience for it.
Really?
Yeah, they want to, I mean, if they're going to spend a half hour, they want to see it on television or whatever.
But even if they're walking in the streets with their iPods, have you considered that? I mean, people do need to listen to something on the subway.
Well, listen, there's the key, to listen. Is it enough to just listen, or do you want to either listen to a book being read, or I don't know. I just don't think people are used to it mentally now.
I'm wondering, have you both done any audiobook work? Because that is an emerging market. You
know? I have read a couple of books.
This producer, Gary Gabriel, did Our Shows. Was it Ours?
Half Hour, I believe.
Oh, they were wonderful. And he played them in the middle of the night on National Public Radio, but we did several of them. They were turn-of-the-century authors like Henry James and Scott Fitzgerald, and we delighted in it, but as Peter said, the audience is minimal.
But I guess I'm wondering if it's this is kind of a sad conversation to have, because...
Not at all.
No, it is, because we're talking about something that there is no audience there, but maybe there is an audience there, and maybe producers...
Are they young people? That's who the advertisers want to reach these days, not the guys who do remember radio or who can appreciate it. They're all, over 65 now?
You're talking to a guy who's in his early 30s who loves old-time radio.
How great!
So I'm trying to point out to you that it's all available through Web Archive. You can listen to The Mysterious Traveler, Dimension X, all this great stuff. The Whistler, I mean, and it's all...
Remember Brett?
But the thing is there are no new talents coming up who are trained in listening to this and actually using these voices and these specific sort of dramas. So I guess going back to my initial question is, do you think that something is possibly being lost in animation, which is an acceptable medium for vocal actors and the like?
Well, I don't know. Animation and anime, I think, takes care of a lot of that, both with the voices and visually at the same time. So I really don't know the answer. However, I don't feel too encouraged.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm wondering, in terms of anime and animation, what's the craziest voice that both of you have done? Have you ever been given sort of strange requests in terms of, you know, going completely off the deep end? Kareen, you have quite a...
Oh, well, I remember one producer called me King of the Barnyard, or Queen of the Barnyard, because I did all these crazy, you know, for pigs and crazy noises that came out of me I didn't know I had. And that was a delight. But I did a lot of baby doll voices. And I remember an audition before we had cell phones. I would check in before we had answering machines, check in at the local phone booth as you walked along. And I was on Fifth Avenue in the 50s. And my agent said, quick, call so-and-so. They need a baby cry. So I called on Fifth Avenue, and I started crying. And everyone stared at me. I got the job, but God, was I embarrassed.
Oh, wow. Well, sometimes desperate times call for desperate measures.
It was a lot of fun.
I'm curious also in terms of preparation you might do. I mean, obviously with animation, it is certainly something that you basically get a job and the next day you're actually in the studio. Do you have any preparation time in terms of like coming up with character motivation or emphasis on lines? And how do you deal with this?
Just do it.
Well, if it's going to be pre-recorded, it depends on the director. He's got a storyboard. He knows if you're supposed to be excited or whatever. And you just go in and do it. Preparation, I don't believe in an actor preparing to do any work in animation vocally.
You just do it.
Well, it isn't that, because a good example is I directed the voices, and with some of them myself, but on a series called Courage the Cowardly Dog. The lady playing the farmer's wife in it, they had sent her the script a few days in advance. And I worked each actor alone on that show, recorded them alone. Anyway, she came in. She was so self-rehearsed, and so had self-rehearsed herself completely out of what she was supposed to be. So after that, she got used to it. I said, you got to forget all that working at home, and you're not going to get the scripts in advance anymore. All that. She got used to it right away and loved it much more.
Huh. So it needs to be spontaneous in order to actually affect results. That a sort of rigid preparation is counterintuitive to animation.
And it could also be completely wrong for what the director had in mind.
How many angles will a director, speaking both as, you know, you're a director and a voiceover artist, Peter, and Corinne, you're also a voiceover artist. I mean, how many different takes will be tried for one character? I mean, what's the most that you've ever actually had?
Well, I've in doing each actor individually, really, it sounds like torture of the worst kind. But he'll be out of there. He's paid for the day, and he'll be out of there in an hour and a half. What I try to get is as many different readings within, you know, the character and what's going on in the story, as many different readings, subtle changes, whatever, so that the animators have choices as to which take to animate to.
When I worked for Disney, they would say, do three in a row. And that was kind of like a joke thing, you know, three in a row, three in a row. And again, you try to make them as varied as possible. Mm-hmm. But we would do three in a row.
Well, I used to, with Lionel Wilson, who played the farmer. And, he cursed me a couple of times because he'd do a very, very good take, and it was fine. And I'd say, you know, that was great, Lionel. Now, let's do one more for safety.
Yeah, that's another term that we use.
He'd flinch, you know, but the one more for safety was even better.
I mean, I'm wondering if there's a sort of maximum number of takes before you get a voiceover actor. I'm sorry.
Well, you've got a sense that the actor can't do any more than what he's given you and move on to the next line.
I could tell you about dubbing with Peter because I was so impressed by this. Let's say you did it four times and you just did not get it. He would move on to the next line and then maybe 10 minutes later go back to the original line that you messed up.
Yeah.
And suddenly you could do it. Getting away from it, stepping back for a minute, really, really changed the whole thing. Right, Peter?
Mm-hmm. Well, that works, I think, for a lot of media. Yeah. You know, writers, I'm sure, get hung up on something and go walk around the block, come back, and don't even think about it, and then sit down and boom, there it is.
That's really it.
I'm curious, do you both have sort of a catalog of voices? I know some voiceover actors actually literally have like lists of hundreds of different characters that they can do. I've actually seen someone go through the list and like, oh, I'll do 132 for you because I think this might, we can work off of this. Do you have anything like this? Or have you even seen something like this?
I have none. No catalog. You know, I wouldn't even dream of it. But I knew a woman and she had a tape or whatever, a CD, and she said, Woman of 1,000 Voices. And we used to call her Woman of 1,000 Voice because every voice she did sounded alike.
That was Gil Mack.
No, that was Ruth. I shouldn't even say.
Oh, wow, really? Okay.
No.
Yeah.
But
Gil used to, in radio, have that joke about
but,
him.
Yeah, well,
but they were
know.
Good, the voices he had.
Yeah.
But you know, it's a joke. I know that Peter and I do not have any catalog. I wouldn't even think of doing that.
This gets in the way of spontaneity, then, I suppose.
Yeah, there are a lot of actors who have certain voices, but I don't believe in having it myself when I'm doing something next week called Penguins. That's all I know about it. All right, I'll go in there. I don't know if I'm going to be an old grandfather penguin or a young penguin or whatever.
I guess I'll
come up with something.
I'm curious as to the relationship between you as a voiceover actor and the director in terms of just you kind of go in cold and the director. Is it the subject of the director or what do you contribute as an actor for these particular voices?
Well, if I'm working just as an actor, I respect everything the director says.
Yeah.
Period. I'm not directing. I'll follow direction completely and forget that I've done any directing.
Yeah.
I may in my head say, wait a minute, well, all right, I'll do it anyway, you know. But no, you got to divorce one from the other or you're second-guessing everything and that leads only to chaos.
Yeah, sure. I had a question about the huh? And the who?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Okay.
I mean, this. I don't know exactly what the methodology is as to how these go in, but they're certainly in Speed Racer. I was watching a number of these. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
The problem is a writer, you know, a lip sync writer, fine, I've got the lips moving, but on those reaction shots, they were just a still, really, of him reacting to something. The sound effects, the music you heard, and it's just him. So you got to fill them with something. You can't just have a mouth open there with nothing coming out of it. So that's how I came up with all the, you know, whatever was going
but
on.
But in particular, the, whole thing, that's been an anime staple.
We have a joke. That's because of the animation.
Well, what do you do if the lips aren't moving, but he's reacting?
Yeah, that's,
you got to do something.
I guess so. I guess you could say, I suppose so, yeah.
Well, now you just did that with your lips closed.
Exactly.
That wouldn't work.
Of course. What was I going to ask you? Oh, I was going to ask you about, actually, I wanted to ask you about the third season of Star Blazers. The first two seasons had actors, and you two both came on board for that. And I'm wondering how that came about.
They wanted me to direct the first two seasons of Star Blazers. Okay. They had already cast it. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I don't know these actors. I mean, maybe they're fine, but I don't know them. And I'm going to go in suddenly direct actors I don't know, and so forth. So I turned the job down. Mm-hmm. So they did the first two. Then Star Blazers was acquired by Westchester Films. I forget the man's name, very nice man. And I said, I don't know these. Same thing as I had said before. I don't know these actors. I can bring in a cast and so forth. And he said, well, do it that way. After all, you're the director of it. So that's how I switched. I know a lot of fans were up in arms about it because I've heard from them.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That was the choice I had to make. I didn't know the other actors at all.
So really, it's impossible for you to direct without other actors? It has to be a sort of familiarity?
It was just, I didn't know them at all. And
They hadn't auditioned.
Well, they did to get the jobs originally, sure.
Oh, I see, but not with you.
But it was also the problem that they were non-union. And you have to be careful if you're working non-union. I, frankly, have always, and I don't mind who listens and hears this, worked both sides. I prefer to work union, but if I'm going to lose the job completely to Vancouver, curses, I'll work non-union.
Huh. I won't. I'm very pro-union, and I bless my union because...
Yes, it gave you a lot of residuals from Speed Racer.
I know,
didn't
we got nothing. We got nothing.
Yeah, I was going to ask
you
about that,
too. Oh, nothing. It's terrible. Anyway, I still...
Well, I mean, you know, this whole notion of not getting residuals for Speed Racer, obviously you could not have predicted at the time the rise of the video revolution and reruns, perhaps, or could you?
No, the truth is they did not have it in the contract till 85, and this was
for
in
animation,
the 60s. For animation, there were no residuals. I know there were a lot of people like the Brady Bunch who got no residuals, a ton of cartoons. And it's horrible because we're famous and poor instead of being famous and rich. But that's the way life goes.
But does the anime convention circuit sort of atone for that or make up for that? Or?
Yes, good
indeed.
Question.
We love it. And the fans, they really are so sincere and they adore us. And, you know, who else gets adulation and praise like that? To go in for 3 days and be adored, I mean, that's a pretty good deal.
Also, we have a bunch of... you know, sort of merchandise and things like that, souvenirs of Speed Racer and all. And if we get a signing table, I believe in signing whatever they bring and not charging for it, unlike a lot of other shows. But if they want something that I've got there on display, there's a price on it, and they'll get it signed and everything else. So make a little money that way. Yeah. I'm not above even selling one item on eBay.
Gotcha. I actually wanted to ask you about the popularity of Speed Racer. I mean, essentially, the sense I'm getting is that you were both working various voiceover jobs and that this kind of thing exploded just because it was like Casablanca. It's essentially, it was just another studio picture. Is there something about constantly working that kind of, that if you work continuously, eventually you'll do one thing that sort of sticks and gets into the public craw like that?
Or? If you're lucky.
No.
No,
it's just the luck of the draw. I mean, you can't predict these things. But Peter, you have a whole formula reason in your head why Speed Racer is famous.
Oh, no, that was only because of the storyline and how it was handled. you know, the family values and everything which were there.
I know that the original Speed Racer was considerably more violent, and that you actually toned down the violence, and I'm wondering why that is. Was it just not suitable for family entertainment?
Well, it was violent, but my best example is, if you call it violence, yes, you would. There's a terrible car crash just over the hill, so you don't see the crash itself. You hear it and everything, and you see arms and legs flying through the air. Well, that's pretty violent. So I would, if I could, throw in lines like, well, he's in serious condition in the hospital, but the doctors say he'll pull through.
Well, there are a couple of things. Like, I saw one Speed Racer where someone was had gotten into a severe car crash, and it was, again, your typical animation of, like, coming out of the smoke with the wheels and things. So I guess, was there enough of that for you to sort of maintain the light tone? Or?
Yeah, I tried to, yeah.
I also wanted to ask you about the sort of the Chim Chim dynamic, because Chim Chim to me is probably the sort of strangest character of the bunch, looking at it from, he's kind of the missing link between you two. So maybe you can sort of talk about this, because I mean it's just this is a chimpanzee. I mean, he goes up and he gets a monkey army to go ahead and just lob stones at various people. That's really impressive. It's like, you know, Trixie and Speed couldn't do that. Not even Racer X.
Yeah.
Well, Chim Chim lived in the trunk with Spritel.
Yeah.
And they lived in the trunk together. And he was adorable. People loved Chim Chim. Did Jackie Grams do him?
Yes.
Yeah, he was just so great.
Once in a while, he couldn't get the Chim Chim sound just right, so we'd lift a little bit from the original Japanese to combine it.
I was curious, how many of the sounds were generated on this, the American version, or were pulled from the Japanese version?
All of it was American. I mean, that was the only instance that I know of was the occasionally one of the Chim Chim sounds. Huh.
As for Spritel to me is also just total punk ass, essentially. So I'm wondering, it became gradually more of a punk ass as the show progressed. And so I'm wondering, in the voiceover work, was there any sort of effort to kind of make Spritel even more effervescent over the course of the run?
Not that I remember.
Well, I think you based him on me. He was always eating candy, and I'm always eating candy, you know. But that was about. Well, I don't hang out in trunks.
If you think about Spritel and Chim Chim, what was illustrated then, with them always hiding in the trunk of the car, that's a total thing against the law now. Any kind of safety.
I know.
Locking kids in in the trunk of a car?
As it's going like 120 miles per hour, no less.
Right.
Too.
Yeah, right. Yeah. They're delightful. I have to tell you a funny thing. At a convention with Jack Grimes, this guy comes up to me and says, you know, you sound like my dog. And Jack, without missing a beat, said, really? Get him an agent and get him into Screen Actors Guild and see what he can do. I couldn't stop laughing. I thought that was so funny.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, in terms of, like, did some of the voices kind of come about? Like, for example, you're getting the shows as they're coming from Japan. Racer X in particular, you don't know what the hell's going on here.
That's
and
right.
Yet I'm wondering how much of this dictated some of the voices between you two and also Jack.
Well, we try to match what the character looked like on the screen, you know, when we're dubbing it. That would be the main thing.
I'm wondering if the sort of evolving storyline caused many of the vocal characterizations to evolve likewise as well.
Well, I never knew how the storyline was going to evolve because I got the scripts, the prints, and the translations very sporadically from Japan. I'd get one week, three the next. I never knew what was coming. Sometimes they'd skip a couple of episodes, and I would get those later. You know, that's what happened with this masked guy who suddenly appeared. I thought, oh boy, we've got a new villain here.
But
Racer X.
Oh yeah, go for it.
No, that was Racer X. I didn't know who he really was until much later when I got an episode from Japan. I said, holy mackerel.
Yeah, yeah.
So he became Rex Racer, yeah. Because I used the X then.
Gotcha. I guess, though, what I'm curious about is that if you can't predict the storyline, is there, and you're sort of being spontaneous in the studio as you're recording these things, I mean, was there any way to sort of like, oh, well, maybe we should, you know, play up Racer X as more mysterious like that?
No, you got to match what's on the screen.
Oh, okay. So it's really just a matter of matching the screen.
Yeah, in this case, because it was dubbing.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Now, I also wanted to ask you, back in those days, I know that you had a sort of collective recording session, and today it's more of sort of one-on-one. Are there any advantages or disadvantages to either of the two forms, both of you? Who?
Well, there were several advantages. I prefer working with one actor at a time now. because you get his best energy or hers in the first hour and a half. You don't have a lot of sitting around while another actor is doing something, then you get him to do a line. You can concentrate and get that out of the actor. Also, it goes faster. There's no chit-chat in the studio between actors. You say, all right, folks, calm down, will you? Shut up, we're trying to record here, stuff like that. It saves money on the studio. Mm-hmm. In other words, instead of, say, an 8 or 9 hour day, you can get done in 6 or 7.
Yeah.
And that's quite a savings.
I loved working with groups. I thought that you played off each other. You got ideas from each other.
You can't play off each other. You got to play off what's on the screen.
Yeah, but still, just being with them, the way they deliver their previous line, gives you a way, I don't know, it keeps you in the mood. I loved it. I thought it was really great.
You now like you go the in sociability
a,
of
well,
it.
Well, I did. Maybe. And now you go in and you do 3 in a row all by yourself, and you don't know who else is in the cast, and maybe you will never meet them in your life.
It sounds kind of lonely the way
it's
you describe it.
It's very lonely. It's aww. Lonely. You, the director's very important.
Peter, here's the clinical technician wanting to save studio money and time. Here.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, a director's got to do that or he gets fired.
Yeah, okay.
In films and whatever.
There's one other thing I wanted to ask you two about, and that is I know that you both did a 1986 Late Night with David Letterman dubbing.
Oh, yes.
I don't think anyone's really asked you about that, but I know that, Corrine, you were Raquel Welch, and Peter, you were David Letterman. It was 60 hours or something of this?
It was 1 hour. Uh-huh. I've got the writers of Letterman got in touch with me. They had this bright idea to revoice a whole show that they, in a repeat, and just put it on the air. So, I organized a cast to do it and did it. It took me 4 mornings to do Letterman because he never shuts up. But he was easy to do because once I got his breathing pattern, he would take a breath and then go on for, a few long phrases.
How about Raquel?
I thought she had the most beautiful lips and articulation I've ever encountered. She was really easy because she had this beautiful mouth and you could see her elocution, her diction, and she was really easy, and I love her for that.
I have to also ask you, Corrine, because one thing watching the Speed Racer cartoons again was that I was struck by how you took these long sentences and somehow found pauses in the middle of them, despite the fact that you're racing a mile a minute. And then I was really impressed by this. I mean, is this really just a matter of breathing?
It's breathing. I remember one actor saying, pretend you're going to jump off the roof of a building, take a deep, deep breath, and go. And that's basically what you had to do. I don't know if I could do it today. I don't breathe as deeply, I don't think.
Yeah. I'm also curious in terms of, Trixie has a sort of really extraordinarily confident aura about her in almost every single appearance. And so how did this develop? It's actually very close to your regular speaking voice, too.
Well, yeah, but I've never been as confident as Trixie. Gosh, she's got it all. She's great. I just did it. What can I tell you? I loved her. I loved doing her, and I didn't.
I mean, I'm wondering if this voice came more natural to you than, say, Spritel.
Well, of course. Of course it did. Yeah.
I mean, was there a sort of, was it there in terms of, is it really just a matter, though, for both of you, just of matching the screen, that this is really the creative interpretation?
Recreative, shall we say.
Well, what you said about storyboards and original cartoons, I get my character by looking at the picture. Mm-hmm. That's how I do it. How do you do it?
What do you do with the storyboards? Is that where you get it from?
Yeah, look at the picture. Like, if their arms are out, they're tough. Or if their arms are together, they're scared.
The actor doesn't get to see the whole storyboard, just to see what that character looks
like.
One frame, picture. But after that, then the director has to follow
the storyboard. But that one thing helps, and that's how I base my characters.
I'm wondering if there's a sort of advantage or disadvantage in terms of visual looking at a storyboard or looking at a piece of film versus actual expression in an actual studio, using your arms to get into a character or possibly crunching up or things like that.
You can use your arms when there's no screen in front of you.
We always do.
Yeah, in radio.
Every good actor does. You use your body, you have to, and then the proper sounds come out.
I also hear that you could use an apple that will actually clear up your throat. Is this true? Do you have any sort of secrets along those lines?
I've never heard that one.
A voiceover person told me this, that you eat an apple, and then the juice from the apple actually opens up your larynx.
I have never heard that in my life, but I'll tell you, I don't like cold water, I like tepid. Mm-hmm. you know, not too hot or cold. And that's and I know if you chew gum and it's cold outside, it helps you articulate. You know, you loosen it, but you can do it with an exercise. Meum, 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 meum.
Oh, okay. And that's what actors do, too. You
know? Yes, but
I've never done it.
No, well, I have if it's like, you know, below zero. And you're freezing to death, and your mouth is frozen.
Well, now you go brrr.
Oh,
you
well, that's one. That's a good one. Brrr is wonderful.
You do the brrr, brrr, brrr. And there's also the meow, meow, meow.
No,
there's
we don't too. Do anything. Oh, okay. We really don't. And I don't think I never. Actually, I remember in a studio, we're all eating everything. It's like chocolate cheese, and someone said it's no good for you. And said, "Yeah, whoever said that?" We continued eating. You know,
oh, wow.
I don't believe in any of that. So you just do what you do.
It sounds to me there's really no Stanislavski preparation for a lot of this stuff.
No way.
Yeah, okay. Well, Corinne, Peter, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much. Well,
thank you so very much, right. And good luck to you.
Here comes the racer. He's a demon on wheels. He's a demon, and he's gonna be chasing after someone.